Okay, welcome back to the Paramedic Practitioner Podcast. It's been a while since our last episode, but I have a really cool topic and a great guest today. We're going to talk about cognitive biases and how these different biases can impact our clinical decision making and can impact the way we treat our patients. My guest today is Dr. Quinn Cummings, and here he is to introduce himself.
Hey, everybody. My name is Quinn. I am an assistant professor of emergency medicine at MUSC in the Medical University of South Carolina in Charleston. And I completed my pediatric emergency medicine fellowship as well as my emergency ultrasound fellowship there. And now I'm faculty. And thanks for having me, Andrew. Really excited to be here to talk about this awesome topic.
So yeah, tell us a little bit about what we're talking about today and why it's important.
Well, I sort of came across this topic when I was a medical student, trying to basically close my knowledge gap and just fill in little holes in my knowledge. And I would see patients with typical chest pain or abdominal pain. And I would still make mistakes despite knowing sort of the core knowledge and knowing the foundations of emergency medicine. And it was a little bit frustrating that there was really no knowledge gap to fill in. I just wasn't implementing it appropriately in my decision making. And so I read a little bit more, listened to some other podcasts, and learned a little bit more about how I did things wrong and how to do things right. And so it really kind of got me interested in delving a little bit more deeply into the sort of psychological aspect of emergency medicine.
That's awesome. Yeah, I think that's a really good point, is that you can have all the knowledge in the world, but if you don't know how to make your brain use it properly, yeah, it's not really going to be very useful for you or your patients. So it's good to talk about these things that can impact our decision making. Right. So what is the definition of cognitive bias?
Well, a cognitive bias is sort of an umbrella term that's used to describe really any error in our thinking that occurs on sort of unconsciously while processing the information that's around us. The lens sort of through which we as individuals see and interpret information can distort the truth. And most of the time, this probably doesn't cause a tremendous amount of harm, but occasionally this sort of systematic error can be devastating, either directly or indirectly, kind of down the line. And really, in some cases, a deviation from a purely rational thought process actually may be preferred. So for example, the bias of what's called base rate neglect, whereby the baseline prevalence of a disease is almost ignored so that we can think about the worst case scenarios and move those up on our differential diagnosis, like someone who's having tearing chest pain radiating to the back and their systolic is 200. You know, it's a highly suspicious story for a thoracic aortic dissection, but statistically, it's still very unlikely, right? So really, you know, we actually are employing some cognitive biases and various scenarios in emergency medicine. So kind of interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's super important. That's a good point of just trying to consider, like, what actually is the likelihood that this is truly this more rare thing versus something that's much more common. So it's a good point to try to balance kind of what you might think it is, but it's more rare against what's actually the most common thing.
Exactly. It's okay to be irrational as long as it's in the interest of patient safety.
Absolutely. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So where do these cognitive biases actually originate from?
Our brains are tasked with taking in and processing an incredible amount of information from our senses. And because of this, we default to being economical and almost cutting corners. And this is where the dual process theory comes in, which was described in the 2011 book, Thinking Fast and Slow. This book was authored by Daniel Kahneman, who, along with Amos Tversky, these two Israeli-American psychologists, they pioneered the field of modern cognitive psychology in the 70s. And the book Thinking Fast and Slow details these two distinct systems of thinking And each of them has their own advantages and shortcomings. So system one thinking is the intuitive and reflexive approach. It involves automatic decision-making based on mostly pattern recognition. It's kind of like your brain on autopilot. One example would be seeing a child with the typical facies of trisomy 21 and saying, oh, that patient must have Down syndrome, right? So just pure pattern recognition. I liken system one to Anakin Skywalker. It's fast, but it's cocky and it's kind of error prone. Now, system two thinking, on the other hand, is the more analytical problem-solving approach, slower, more deliberate. One example would be like creating a differential diagnosis or walking a learner through the steps of a procedure. Probably more likely to lead you to the correct diagnosis, but more resource-intensive for sure and laborious. So I think of this one as the Master Yoda approach. It involves more of the prefrontal cortex and less of the limbic system. But ultimately, in the end, it's really not which system is better. I think they both play their part in emergency medicine in various ways. It's really sort of learning to toggle between both systems, you know. But most of the time, we're in system one. And exact reasons why we're in system one isn't clear, but probably conferred an evolutionary benefit, whereby those of our ancestors that sort of chose to run away from whatever predator was hunting us, you know, those are the ones that were more likely to survive than those who chose to, you know, sit back and judiciously weigh the risks and benefits of escaping. You know, now we don't have too many predators endangering our lives or competing for our food supply, but the imprint of, you know, that sort of evolutionary effect remains.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that it makes a lot of sense for us, especially in emergency medicine or EMS, to be in system one. We're trying to deal with oftentimes in the ED, multiple patients, but pre-hospitally, one super sick patient a lot of the time that we have to make pretty quick decisions on. So our system one has to function pretty well. So over time, we gradually, our system one gets better as we see more patients and we kind of develop these patterns that we learn to recognize as we get better. So a lot of times initially we're in system one, we can address the major things and then, okay, we can take a step back and pop into system two to see, okay, what are we missing? What other things do we need to be doing for this patient? What else could this be?
Right. And I think the ability to toggle again back and forth between both of those, you know, running the cardiac arrest resuscitation and then stopping and thinking, what are my H's and T's? What are some, you know, of the etiologies? What are the sort of next best steps? Okay, then back into system one because now they're in VFib and I know exactly what to do.
Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely. So what are some of the specific cognitive biases? Like what are some of the common things that people fall victim to in emergency medicine treating these sick people?
I mean, there are hundreds, you know, that we encounter every day, not only in emergency medicine or in medicine in general, but, you know, in life. Some of the more common ones that I think we bump into. So we'll start with anchoring bias. So the anchoring bias reflects a tendency to cling to salient or vivid features of a complaint or presentation and failing really to adjust this first impression as more evidence becomes available. I kind of say once the anchor is out, really the ship doesn't move. And there are a lot of very similar biases like premature diagnostic closure, the sunk cost fallacy, and really this kind of carries on down the road, not only in the emergency department, but throughout the patient's hospital course. So let's say, for example, you have a patient in the ICU and they're signed out to you with a presumed diagnosis of septic shock. And they're on multiple pressors. Chest x-ray reveals a multifocal pneumonia. They've had 9 COVID tests and they're all negative. But it basically becomes really, you know, difficult for your brain to look past the septic shock part of that and consider something like hemodynamically significant endocarditis with a valve rupture. So just kind of having that diagnostic label, it goes from being tentative to being, this is what the diagnosis is, and there's nothing you can really do about it because it's already been passed on down the line, and you're just another sort of piece of that chain. And it's hard to sit back and break that chain once sort of it's already been started.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the anchoring bias is one of my favorites. We actually had a patient last month at MUSC who came in, been seen multiple times for nausea, vomiting at other hospitals, was diagnosed with cannabinoid hyperemesis syndrome. And mm-hmm. we easily could have just treated her for cannabinoid hyperemesis syndrome, but we talked specifically about the importance of ruling out worse things. So we did a workup, we got some imaging, and she ended up having a perforated viscous, free air in her belly, needed to go emergently to the operating room. So it's important to kind of block out the nagging thing or the main thing you're focused on and make sure that you're considering all the important data points when you're assessing a patient.
Right. And, you know, the way that you take a history, you know, the way that you perform a physical exam can really affect how sort of how that diagnosis comes about. Like if you say, oh, does your abdominal pain get better with hot showers? Why, yes, doctor, it does. Oh, okay. Now we're getting somewhere. Well, guess what? Hot showers feel good. Hot showers feel good to anybody with abdominal pain, including patients with cannabinoid hyperemesis syndrome. But that's a sort of a feature of the history that you cling to. And that once that anchor is out, the ship doesn't move. And that's kind of scary how easy it can be to fall victim to that bias.
Yeah, absolutely. It's incredibly easy. And it's something that happens so commonly, which is why I think it's so important to talk about this topic and make sure that we're consciously trying to avoid falling victim to these biases by keeping our minds open to alternative ideas and not focusing in on one thing.
Right. And what's really fascinating specifically about anchoring bias is that you really can't get over it. Like once you have that piece of information that your brain, for whatever reason, decides it's relevant, it cannot discard it. They've done studies about anchoring bias and where they have tried to say, here's what anchoring bias is. Don't get anchored by this one piece of information. You know, it's just a piece of the puzzle. And then they performed the experiment and they couldn't prevent the anchoring. They went so far as to pay people to teach them about it, warn it, and then paying these study participants not to be influenced by it. And they still couldn't prevent themselves from being anchored.
Yeah, it's amazing how strong the mind is and how much subconsciously is going on and is really impacting your clinical decision making. And it really can lead to other things. Like there's also another big one that we see in emergency medicine is confirmation bias, where we've already decided on a diagnosis, so we just look for more evidence to confirm what we already believe is true. And this happens so much in EMS, where if we're dispatched for a specific complaint, a lot of times we subconsciously anchor in on it being that complaint, and we either forget to look for the things, or we look for only things that lead us more toward that complaint. Even if we're trying not to have that happen, it's certainly something that happens. Or you walk into the nursing home and the nurses say, oh, we think she's having a stroke, and you forget to check the blood glucose. So it's certainly important in those situations as well. Are there any other common situations or complaints that can predispose people to fall victim to these cognitive biases?
Well, I think most of your sort of high risk scenarios are pretty much unavoidable, practically speaking. When you're working in the pre-hospital setting or in the emergency department where it's chaotic and frenetic, it's almost like a petri dish for cognitive error. You know, decisions must be made very quickly, and remembering to take that cognitive step back and also committing to taking that cognitive step back can be tough or even impossible. And that's not even mentioning the unfavorable signal-to-noise ratio that we're subjected to. Also, really, like by the end of the shift, you know, let's say it's been a long shift. If you're working a 24, or if you're working, you know, a 10, 12-hour shift in the ER, you know, you've made hundreds of decisions by the end of the shift, whether you recognize it or not. And our brains are, they're economical beings. You know, they make a lot of decisions, and that can be costly and really overwhelming to our brain's capacity to handle a cognitive load. And at some point, the brain just stops and says, all right, we're only doing system one until the shift is over. And that can be deadly. Other scenarios that I think are also pretty high risk are scenarios that have high what's called emotional valence. So if you're really excited because you just learned this new technique on how to reduce a shoulder, and your excitement sort of to perform this technique, and you're really pretty proud of yourself for learning it and you perform it correctly, but it turns out that the patient has a scapular fracture, and just by manipulating it, you know, that patient never needed that, and it really just ultimately did harm to the patient. But that sort of bias about excitement, you know, that kind of blinded you to what was right for the patient.
Yep, absolutely. That's a really good point. Is there anything specifically, or any actions that we can take to avoid falling victim to these cognitive biases?
Yeah, there are a few freebies. I say freebies in that it's something that you can do beforehand, sort of before the shift, to just prep yourself for the shift. So like easy things like making sure you're well rested, making sure you're well hydrated, and that you eat. Now, I mean, again, in the pre-hospital and the emergency department setting, you might go the whole shift without eating or peeing or, you know, drinking more than, you know, a 4-ounce cup of water. So just, I mean, I don't want to say wellness because it sounds kind of, you know, mushy, but like really taking care of yourself, taking care of your body, eating M&Ms if you need to, you know, grab a Snickers because you're hungry and, you know, you're hangry and you need to be better. but what's more, I guess, interesting to me, and something that I've been trying to encounter or discover more of them as I have sort of grown as a clinician, have been called, they're called cognitive forcing strategies. So anytime, and this is basically just like me ranting at interns at this point, but anytime a patient comes in, like the nursing triage note or the chief complaint, you know, really, really has a huge effect on what happens to that patient. Sickle cell pain crisis, right? That's a diagnosis of exclusion. Sickle cell patients are at higher risk for legitimate pathology. So thinking of all the other diagnoses like compartment syndrome, septic arthritis, osteomyelitis, pretend that sickle cell pain crisis doesn't even exist. Put that at the very bottom of your list. Assume it's something else first. It doesn't mean that you need to do every test in the world. It doesn't mean that, you know, every patient needs to have a SED rate and CRP. Some of these patients don't even need labs at all. It's interesting because that's a diagnosis of exclusion, but it's also a clinical diagnosis. And when I have other clinicians come in and ask me, you know, should we order a CBC and a differential and a reticulocyte count? No, not necessarily. But you should consider every emergency diagnosis. It should enter your brain, and it should either be moved up the differential diagnosis, or not necessarily discarded, but moved, you know, further down the list so that you've at least considered all the emergencies. And then ultimately, whenever you decide it's probably just an acute painful episode that's associated with sickle cell, okay, well, then let's treat them. You know, but that sort of cognitive forcing strategy of saying it's not a pain crisis, it's something else first. Stop there. Let's go back and make sure that we're not missing something. And there's, you know, cognitive forcing strategies, not only for diagnostics, but also like imaging. So it's one where, you know, being systematic as you're going through a chest x-ray, you know, looking at the airway and the bones and the cardiac silhouette, rather than I ordered this radiograph because my patient has dyspnea. Let's look at their lungs. And you completely miss the necrotizing soft tissue infection in their axilla. Because that wasn't their complaint, but it's so easy to do things easily. Mm-hmm. That's the main problem. It's so easy to just fall into a pattern of just being lulled into what the patient, not what they need, but sort of what the patient thinks that they need. Mm-hmm. And it's up to you to find out what they're there for and to do what's right for them. And sometimes that you know, involves straying from your normal practices. And I think that's okay.
Yeah, that is a really good point of how the brain always wants to take shortcuts. It always wants to use that system one, that pattern recognition, and just go down the easiest route. And you really have to force your mind to stay open, keep it on the right track, and make sure you're not missing anything major in your diagnosis or your treatment plan. To bring that kind of back to pre-hospital, if you, you know, I've had, when you walk up to the scene, the first responder's outside tells you, you know, the patient's got a stomach ache, maybe like the stomach flu, and then you walk in and you can either let your brain take you down that route or you can do the EKG, which is going to show that the patient's actually having an MI. So you definitely have to make sure that you keep that open mind, keep your differential long and rule those things out however you need to, whether it's just by kind of clinically saying, okay, this isn't likely, or doing some sort of testing or some sort of assessment to rule it out. Just keeping that open mind, I think, is super important.
Right. I remember that the one of the more common causes of death in the early 1900s was indigestion, which tells me that that was probably inferior MI.
Yep, exactly. And it can happen today, too, if you don't.
Yeah. And one other cognitive forcing strategy that I think can be used, especially by paramedics and emergency providers. It's just kind of being emotionally kind of neutral and kind of like, I'm known for being really excited and you know, excited about doing ultrasound and excited about teaching and all this. But like I said, like that really predisposes us to blind spots. So like, let's say you have a known high ED utilizer, right, with an alcohol use disorder, and they come in all the time. You know, it's easy to just say, oh, you know, we're en route to your facility with a patient with a chief complaint of alcohol intoxication. Okay, is that their chief complaint, or is their chief complaint ultra mental status? Right? Because it's easy for those patients, you see them all the time, you might overlook minor head trauma, and that could be the only sort of subtle clue that their chief complaint of ultra mental status is actually due, you know, to a subacute subdural hemorrhage.
Yep. And that's a very classic example, which I think happens more often than we like to admit. A patient you see all the time that can really throw you for a loop could be the same exact patient that you have seen 10 times. Then the 11th time comes in and they have a head bleed. So always have to start fresh every time, as tough as it can be sometimes.
Right. And I just think that sort of 60-second encode is so crucial, and just trying to make sure that it's systematic is really important to just not carry on a sort of incorrect diagnostic momentum.
Quinn, this has been awesome. I really appreciate you coming on the podcast. This is such an important topic, and I hope people can get something out of it and hopefully implement some of these tips and tricks into their practice.
Thanks so much for having me. I just want, if I could have really one take-home point from this, it would just be that really remember that every piece of the history and each single physical exam finding, all of that is just a single data point. So have a sort of almost a detached skepticism, not only to the veracity of them, but to the importance of them. And just don't assign too much diagnostic weight onto one single finding. And if you just take a step back, be humble, remember that, you know, if you're making mistakes, then you're seeing enough patients, and that's okay. Go back, take a little extra time, examine your own reasoning and decision-making more broadly, and just sort of reflect on your own experience. Because if you don't, you know, you can build up your confidence incorrectly. If you're, you know, a pre-hospital provider, ask one of the docs about a patient that you brought in earlier. Follow up on your patients, because you'll be surprised what you find. Because we are.
Yep, that's an incredibly good point. I really like that. And yeah, the idea of follow-up is so important, and something EMS providers do not get a ton of. So it's hard to develop your system one or system two thinking without knowing what your patient actually had. You don't really know if your assessment was correct or if your differential was even close. And I've certainly been pretty far off, and getting follow-ups really helpful. That's a super good point. So yeah, Quinn, thank you so much. This has been awesome. I really appreciate you coming on the podcast.
Great. Thanks so much for having me, Andrew.
Thank you for listening to the Paramedic Practitioner Podcast. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram, and you can also get me on Twitter at amerlman and email amerlman@gmail.com. Also, be sure to check out our sponsor, Prodigy EMS, for your learning management system needs. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you soon.